You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is named Person of the Year by Time magazine. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Martin Plaut will be here to give us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories, including Brazil's unfolding political crisis continues as the Supreme Court suspends Dilma Rousseff's impeachment process. And also ahead, we look at two very distinct African leaders, one who wants to extend his term in office, another rolling up his sleeves literally to clean up the streets. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So hello and welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Martin Plaut. Martin Plaut is a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University here in London. Martin and Oscar, welcome to you both. Let's begin by having a look today at Angela Merkel. The German Chancellor has just been named Person of the Year by Time magazine. Her leadership role in Europe's migration crisis and refugee crisis was one of the main reasons for this nomination, according to Times editor Nancy Gibbs, citing that she asked more of her country than most politicians would dare. And Martin Plaut, that's very true, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, her open arms approach to refugees, which has been welcomed, of course, by the Syrian refugees and the others coming across the border into Greece, has been extraordinary. And, hundreds of thousands of people have taken up her offer to come or try to come to Germany and have poured across Eastern Europe. The consequences are almost unknowable, but it was a very heroic decision.
And Oscar, something that it has been difficult for her to push through in Germany, surprisingly so, in that we expect Angela Merkel to, with her large majority and her huge public support, to be able to pretty much steer the German ship in whichever way she might wish. But she has had some quite serious internal opposition this time, hasn't she?
That's the real test of leadership, when you take a moralist standpoint, which is ethically sound, and in spite of the potential political fallout, you manage to navigate through the difficulties and take your people where they should be going. That's clearly what has made her an exemplar this year.
How much is this going to help her, though, necessarily, Martin? Because, it's all very well and good, getting a nice bauble and being a pat on the head from an international magazine. And we've given other leaders as well a bit of a pat on the head as well from time to time. It doesn't necessarily help with your own population, with your own electorate, does it?
No, I mean, her popularity is falling fast. And as her Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble has said, she's a careless skier. She has precipitated an avalanche. And clearly there is grave concern in places like Dresden, where there are weekly protests against the arrival of the migrants, and places which are just, I haven't been to Germany recently myself, although I am actually German. There are places which are feeling completely overwhelmed by the number of people that are arriving. Of course, there is a positive in all of this for Germany itself, which is that Germany has such a low birth rate, as many European countries do, places like Italy, for example, that if they are going to survive and grow, they actually do need young, vigorous migrants, especially ones who have the get up and go to come across half a continent over, endless borders and through many difficulties. These are not idiots who have arrived in Germany. They are really, really clever, powerful people, and they will do well, and they will actually help the German economy. They are the people who are going to provide all the healthcare in years to come. So there's a plus for her, but in the short term, certainly it's a minus.
There is one striking thing about this, Oscar, in that it really highlights how personality is often actually far more important than many people give credit in politics. That the whims, the thoughts, the morals and ethics of one particular leader at one particular time can have an enormous impact on how the world works.
Institutions and superstructures are very important in politics, but we should not forget that individual traits and the characteristics of personality and psychology do matter. And this is precisely what I was referring to when I said that she has become an exemplar of leadership. It is the case that she's going to face very difficult political waters in the short term. And yet, it is important to know, to remember that this kind of fiber, which, as the editor of Time pointed out, is much lacking in today's politics, is still there incarnated in someone.
We have a bit of a leadership theme in today's program. Everything we're going to talk about is to do with a leader in some way or another. But Martin, when you look at the way Angela Merkel now operates, can you think of other examples around the world in politics right now of politicians who feel they are strong enough to follow their own beliefs come what may?
Gosh, that's a good question.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
I suppose Mr. Modi, in a way, in India, is a pretty tough leader. He hasn't forced through quite as much as he assumed he would, but he's gone quite a long way in liberalizing India and in trying to drag it towards a more Hindu culture, which is not one that is going to be, you know, very popular with the hundreds of millions of Muslims. So I suppose he's won. But, you know, this exemplar of leadership, yes. But, you know, the other two people who won the Time magazine award were Stalin and Hitler. So you can be an exemplar of leadership and not necessarily be leading in quite the right direction.
No, indeed. This is, it's worth pointing out, they didn't choose Stalin or Hitler because they thought they were particularly good. It was it's the person they feel has had most influence over the news.
Yeah.
And one wonders whether if they'd chosen it last week, it might have been Donald Trump, which might have been mildly embarrassing for them right now. We're not talking about him today. It's a Trump-free zone on Midori House. Oscar, on that question then, you know, that Martin tried to answer there and sort of said perhaps Narendra Modi, is there anyone that you think right now either is doing this or you think actually could be in a position to if they just had a bit of guts?
I wouldn't have chosen Modi at all. I would still go for José Pepe Mujica, the former president of Uruguay, who continues to lead by example, and someone who has the potential to do that, and I'm sure this will be controversial, Pablo Iglesias in Spain.
And what about President Obama?
Well, indeed, I was going to say, no, but that's, yeah, it's interesting you raised that. What about Barack Obama? You know, he is coming to the end of his second term. I'm going to get Martin on this first, Oscar, then you can jump in. I know you want to jump in on this. But, you know, he's coming to the end of his second term. He has tried to do what he can about guns, and there seems there is a limit to what the American public will actually accept on that. He might be, you know, trying to do what he can on climate change. We'll see what happens in Paris over the next few days. Martin, do you think that he has it in him to make one big push on one big issue before he goes?
I think that he has done something which I wouldn't have thought possible in his first term, which is that he has actually succeeded in driving through a number of really tough issues, particularly healthcare, of course, and also in showing a certain leadership and a moral leadership in America, which is really pretty admirable. So I think he's done extraordinarily well, especially given the appalling hand that he was dealt and how badly he performed in the first in his first term. I think, you know, I would certainly say he's sort of 80 or 90% there to get the marks.
Oscar, I imagine you might be willing to give him 80, 90% for domestic policy, but not for foreign policy.
That's it. I want to sympathise with him, and I do sympathise with what Martin has said. But I must remind our listeners that there is a tremendous bridge open at the heart of America. Yes, you have an African-American president, and at the same time, this is the period in which African-Americans have suffered the most, and Black Lives Matter is there. You know, that movement is there to remind us of what's haven't been possible for Obama.
Let's move on now to another elected leader who I think is unlikely is ever going to be up for any Person of the Year awards anytime soon, and that is Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff. And Oscar Guardiola Rivera, you know, we've had another chapter today with this impeachment process, the country's Supreme Court suspending the impeachment process, although there are many twists and turns still for this to go. You know, ignoring the daily wrinkles to this story, you know, this is a quite dramatic fall from grace for Dilma Rousseff, isn't it?
It is a dramatic fall from grace, particularly if you take into account her past history. You know, here you have a heroic figure who survived torture under the Brazilian dictatorship, who was hailed as, at the very least, a good technocrat, if not. She was. We were always told that she wasn't charismatic, but she may have failed even on that front, which is a shame. Not just for her, but also for the Workers' Party, which stands accused internally, in fact, of having broken its links with the social movements. And that's what is at the heart of this problem, that division between them, the social movements, and also the party which Da Cunha and others lead, which is part of the coalition. The persons who are leading the impeachment procedure in parliament are in fact part of the coalition. But there are, as you said, wrinkles here. There is revenge, there are Shakespearean tones to this, but it comes at the wrong time.
Martin Plaut, this wasn't supposed to be the story of the Brazilian decade, was it? This was the decade where they were hosting the World Cup and they were hosting the Olympics and the economy was booming and it was, you know, part of the BRICS, and this was, you know, the new force in the world, diplomatically, economically, politically, and it just hasn't happened.
Well, that is the problem with you know, those things that rocket upwards and then sort of fizzle out. It is a problem, right? In a sense, we're all now living with the Chinese example, which is exactly the same. You know, huge growth, and then oh my goodness, we hit a brick wall. But perhaps one is looking at this too pessimistically, and perhaps Brazil will indeed come and, you know, make good in due course, and perhaps this is just a blip. I don't know. I'm not a specialist in Latin America. It's not really my area. But what is sad about this is that she comes in the wake of someone like Lula, who really was an amazing figure and, you know, of world stature. And, you know, it's sad that, you know, his successor now here turns out to be yet another, you know, grubby politician.
But that's perhaps sort of hitting, you know, part of the problem there, isn't it, Oscar, in that, you know, Lula da Silva was a charismatic leader. He gained this reputation all over the world as being someone who sort of slightly changed the face, really, of how Brazil was seen. And he has demonstrated, again, the power of what a good leader can do. And as you say yourself, you know, Dilma Rousseff, she was a chief of staff. She was a technocrat. She was a backroom woman. She wasn't the front guy, was she?
And this is a regional problem. And the left in Latin America has been unable to produce the next generation of powerful leaders. That's a problem in Argentina, a problem in Venezuela, also a problem in Brazil. And we must ask ourselves why that is the case. Why is it that particularly this progressive, more moderate left, if you want to, has been unable to produce another generation of leaders?
And why do you think that is the case?
I think it has to do with the particular history, not cultural traits, but the particular history of the left in Latin America, which tends to be a bit too personalistic. That also has to do with the fact that the constitutional and political arrangements of Latin America are also presidentialist, and that works in favor of this personalism, which does not help parties to organize themselves in a way that would allow them to continue with different leaders.
We're going to come on to leaders in Africa in a moment in some more detail, but Martin, just on that point that Oscar raises there, It's very similar to the case you find in a lot of African countries after independence, that there was a charismatic first leader, but either the charismatic first leader stayed around for a very long time, or when there was a second leader, they didn't quite have the same something.
Although that's certainly true. I mean, you only got to look at someone like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana. I mean, you know, it was, although there were good leaders after him, I mean, there was nobody who came close to him. But then, you know, you don't have to look at Africa. Look at Britain. Who have we got leading the Labour Party? Jeremy Corbyn? Excuse me.
Well, we may have a conversation about that. I don't think that Cameron is either a brilliant example of
By comparison,
kind of
I'm afraid
leadership.
He's a giant.
We can have a conversation.
We'll move on from British politics. You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll be in Venezuela and also East Africa. Stay tuned.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
Refugees are entering the European Union and, for that matter, the Schengen area at Greece. And nothing is being done either by Greece or by the European Union as a whole.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
The way Apple Pay works is that it uses the same technology that a contactless credit card, but that only works with a contactless card reader.
And catch up with Monocle's bureau around the world.
Being Japan, they're very confident that there will be a stadium by spring 2020, even though at the moment there's no design and no architect. So I don't know, fingers crossed at this point.
Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in studio, Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Martin Plaut. Now, the tale of two presidents in East Africa. In Rwanda, President Paul Kagame, who has been in office since the year 2000, is hoping to be able to have a third term in office, a third 7-year term in office. There'll be a referendum vote next week. Not only will he be allowed to have an extra 7 years if this vote goes through, he will then be able to serve for another 2 5-year terms if he wins those elections, which means he could remain in power up until 2034. And yet, over in Tanzania, also in East Africa, the new president, John Magufuli, has been cleaning up the streets of the capital together with citizens. It's part of his promise to crack down on corruption, replacing the celebrations of Independence Day with a major citywide cleanup operation. He has also, Martin Plaut, been known for turning up at government offices in the morning to check that everyone's there and everything's working all right. This is two very different examples of leadership in East Africa. First of all, let's talk about John Magufuli in Tanzania. Something of a breath of fresh air.
He is. Kikwete, whom he replaced, had served his time. But you know, there is one big difference between the two places. In Rwanda, the streets are spick and span, and there's no democracy.
Yes.
And in Tanzania, the place is a mess, and there's plenty of democracy. And perhaps that is the difference between the two places. But, you know, Tanzania has always had a very, it's a charming, bit lazy kind of place where, you know, the sun shines and it's a good place to be. And it's had lots of pretty good politicians. I mean, I remember Julius Nyerere, who introduced some particularly stupid policies like the Ujamaa villages, which practically bankrupted the country. And but Tanzania's sort of muddled along, and it hasn't got into huge fights with its neighbours or itself.
Or itself, because that's the interesting thing about Tanzania, is that it's always had, you know, there's a sense of Tanzanian identity that you get there, which, for example, is missing in much of Kenya.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true, and a lot of the divisions have been overcome. I mean, the only place which is always feels itself slightly outside of it is, of course, Zanzibar, which has, you know, in a sense, it has a stronger sort of Arab and Muslim identity, and that has always felt it's been more tense, and there have been attempted coups and all sorts of things. But Tanzania itself is a pleasant, charming place, not exactly in cracking form, but not bad at all.
It's interesting you mentioned Zanzibar. I once tried to convince a foreign editor of mine that the elections in Zanzibar were really, really important and they must be covered. And to be fair to me, in East Africa, in that context, they really were. But he just saw a request for me to go to Zanzibar for 2 weeks and didn't let me go. Oscar, let's look at Rwanda. Paul Kagame is still feted by many Western leaders. In some ways, they are right to fate him, as Martin says. It's a country, okay, it's not the most democratic in the world, but if you want to look at Millennium Development Goals, if that's the sort of thing that turns you on, they do very well in those. It's a country that's made huge progress and is still in one piece, which, given everything that happened just over 20 years ago, is a remarkable achievement.
And that explains why... You know, that he might win the referendum, and why he went for a referendum rather than just imposing his will. Mind you, the contrast between this story and the previous one does tell us that there is nothing culturally specific about this. It's very important to point that out. This is not an African problem. There is no African obsession or Latin American obsession with staying in power. It is of the nature of power that it seduces those who achieve it in that way. In this case, what we have is indeed a leader which has work, and the people are going to allow or not a third term. We must also remember that institutions are varied. And we might criticize. I'm personally against re-elections after re-elections. But there are other systems, such as the parliamentarian system here in Britain, which would allow a leader to stay for a very long time. At least that was the case before the fixed term Parliamentary Act. And thus, that in itself is not a criterion to be critical. The point is to make sure that if he continues to work and the people continues to support him, and this is genuine support rather than otherwise, the democratic institutions do not suffer.
Here's the test then, Martin. And now, obviously, you know, the economy is not everything, far from it. But if you were to take a bet now on whether Tanzania's economy or Rwanda's economy would have improved much over the next 5 years, I imagine your money would be on Rwanda.
Yeah.
Oh, it certainly would. But I mean, you know, there's one thing in your introduction which I didn't agree with, which was when you said he was hoping to win the election. No. Paul Kagame is organizing.
Yes. Yeah, he knows. You know, he knows.
He's one of those people I was trying to be kind. Indeed. I've interviewed him, and he is a stellar performer. I mean, he's incredibly clever, but he has the coldest eyes I have ever come across in any president. And I mean, just to give you one example of what he's doing, there's a piece in the New Times, his local newspaper, which he runs, of course, which says that he has promoted 5,727 officers in the Rwandan Defence Force. Now, you don't do that if a week before a referendum without a good idea in mind. And you know, if you look at Rwanda and you think of South Africa, you understand the issue. If all the Tutsis were white instead of being black, the parallels would be shocking, because there are 15% of the population are Tutsi, and that was the same proportion, more or less, as the whites were in South Africa. And the Tutsi will never, never allow the Hutu to express their majority support. They don't care what happens. They don't care how many people it takes to kill. They will hold on to power. And Paul Kagame is utterly ruthless in doing this.
They would also turn around and say, well, firstly, they'd say, there are no Hutus and Tutsis anymore, we're all Rwandan.
Oh, that's complete nonsense. Mm.
But they would also point out that, well, 20 years ago, there was a genocide and the Hutus killed 800,000 of us.
Yes, and who sparked that off? It was Paul Kagame by shooting down the plane. I'm afraid we have plenty of evidence.
There would also be many, many people who would say that's absolutely not true.
No, there would actually be a minority of people who say that's not true. All the major people who have looked at this issue have come to the same conclusion, and that is that Paul Kagame was behind that.
There are a number of people, including
influential people within, for example, Human Rights Watch, who know that this is the case. I'm afraid, the evidence is absolutely clear, and the man has blood on his hands from one end to the other.
Okay, on that point, I would say that the evidence might be clear to you, but to others, they would still argue it isn't. We'll move on from that from that issue, if you don't mind. I want to move on finally to another sort of, in no way controversial topic, and that's Venezuela. We've had elections there this week, Oscar Gordillo Rivera, and the opposition has won. And to the surprise of some, the president, Nicolas Maduro, has accepted that fact. Is the Bolivarian revolution over now?
No, 40% of the voters still support that cause. It must be pointed out and emphasized that those who used such terms as a dictatorship or a failed state must now eat their own words. In a dictatorship, the opposition doesn't win elections, and if they do so, the dictator doesn't allow that to go forward.
No,
and
in fact,
Maduro never promoted a few thousand members of the army to make sure that the results were.
It's also worth pointing out
Maduro
did also put in jail the leader of the opposition a year or so ago.
He's not the leader of the opposition. He's the leader of one of the factions of the opposition, and actually the one that most Venezuelans did not vote. It's very important to take into account, not because of that, it's very important to take into account that Capriles and Leopoldo López's wife, plus other leaders, held different press conferences the very day after
Okay,
election.
This is splitting hairs. Whether he was leader of the opposition opposition leader, he was put in jail.
Oh, absolutely. He was put in jail.
That doesn't say to me
he was put in jail. Well, no, the argument could be also that he was put in jail in a judicial procedure that might be questionable. But if it is to be questioned, that should be done through the channels of the Inter-American Human Rights Court.
One question for Martin on this issue. How does, looking from afar, how does Venezuela put itself back together again after a process like this? This is a nation that has been divided for politically divided for as long as anyone can remember. And, there is nothing necessarily wrong with political division. It's what happens in healthy democracies. But this hasn't been very healthy.
I must tell you, I haven't the faintest idea. I would have to be absolutely honest. Putting together any country which has really fallen apart is always difficult, and nothing is more difficult than holding together a polity which doesn't really exist.
I don't think the country's falling apart, but you're absolutely right, Martin, in pointing out that to put these people together, all these various leaders, is going to be difficult, particularly for the opposition. What I can bet is that it's going to be very difficult for the opposition to select a candidate, either Capriles or López, for the presidential election, which is the real test. And that speaks volumes about the kinds of divisions that we see in Latin America. They're not just left and right. There are other issues under it.
And actually, in a sense, it's worse than there being just left and right, because at least then there are, there are political ideologies and beliefs that people can unite around. It seems there is a lot here about, to go back to where we began, a lot about personalities.
A lot about personalities, a lot about economic interests trying to come back into the region.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Martin Plaut, thank you both very much. I think we've covered a lot of ground there, over 30 minutes. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Carlos Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strunk. The studio manager was Kieran Banaji. For the next half hour, Ben Ryland will be here with Monocle's international playlist. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. That's 1900. The Monocle Daily at 2200. We're back at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800. Here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.